One in five Americans has learned a new language on their bucket list, or life backlog, if you will. If that's you, make 2024 the year you finally check it off the list with Babbel. Upgrade your personal skill set in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Its tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and deliver with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I have a trip to Mexico coming up, so I've been using Babbel to brush up on my Spanish. The courses are short and sweet, so I can do one whenever I have a few minutes to spare. And the words and phrases it teaches you are designed for practical, real-world use, like ordering at a restaurant or asking for directions. Babbel can even provide you feedback on your pronunciation with its speech recognition tech. And it's not just for Spanish. Babbel includes 14 different language courses, each backed by a 20-day money-back guarantee. Here's a special limited-time deal for Scoop Nation. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, only for our listeners, at babbel.com/gamescoop. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/gamescoop, spelled BABBEL.com/gamescoop. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to IGN Game Scoop. I'm your host, Damon Hatfield. Joining me this week here in the LA studio is Nick Lamone.
Hey, everybody.
Joining us remotely are Sam Claiborne.
Here we go!
Is that right?
Auditioning. Yeah, auditioning. There's a new Mario voice open up out there I can be.
Yep.
Oh.
If I do really good.
And yeah. Mark Medina.
Do you think they're still hunting for the voice of Mario for Mario Wonder? They're like, haven't nailed it down yet.
They're going to throw out everybody else. They're going to say, who was that Mario-like man?
They're like, also, you have a month to record 3 lines.
I just want to be a Mario ambassador. That's all. That's all I really want out of
it. No one knows what that is still. Not even Charles Martinet knows what that is.
But I want it.
Okay. What does Mario say when he throws Bowser off the ledge, Mark? Is it so long, King Bowser?
I think it's Big Bowser.
So long, Big Bowser. Okay.
I think it's Big Bowser. Yeah.
I like King
Maybe
Bowser.
Maybe he's just saying, so long, Go Bowser.
Yeah, it could be.
Mark, you played that level more than anybody on Earth.
I know, but there's no subtitles in the game. I've looked. I can't find any.
That's going to be the job for the next Mario Ambassador. Yeah.
Exactly.
To write subtitles for Mario 64.
Yeah.
Okay, so your first job today.
Go back to 1996 game.
Well, in any case, we've got a great show for you this week. There are so many big games out now that we need to talk about, especially since we had the week off last week. Man, there's just a lot to get to. We'll talk about the updates we've learned from Super Mario Bros. Wonder, which I think is looking awesome. And I will share the absolute best game I've been playing lately, and the answer might surprise you. But first,
won't surprise me.
Starfield, the seven heard round the world. What a spicy week this has been for everyone out there in the gaming community. Starfield, we're all playing it. Mm-hmm. Yes, some of us have beat it. Actually, one of us have beaten it. Sam has beaten it.
I think Mark and I have both beat it. I beat it before Mark, though. Mark and I got stuck in the same part near the end of the game.
Really?
Yeah, they kind of throw a thing at you. Like, they're like, hey, you actually don't need to do this. And then at the end of the game, they're like, never mind.
It's not a spoiler. There's just a space battle, and you didn't have to have a space battle before that. You could have opted into space battles before that. But by the end of the game, you have to do one. Mm-hmm. And both of us had very underpowered ships because the game doesn't care if you upgrade your ship or not. It just doesn't care. Starfield don't care.
Yeah, it's one of those like, I'm not complaining about it. The game does allow you to ignore that entire mechanic, and I did. Yeah. And then it's like, oop, shouldn't have done that though. You're dead.
What did you end up doing? Did you just end up stealing a ship?
Like I stole a ship. Yep.
Yeah. And if anybody wants a better ship, you don't need to upgrade or build your ship or anything. What you do is you land on your planet, any planet, and you just listen for the sound of engines, and like maybe one out, what do you say, Mark? Maybe one out of three times
a ship flies over when you
land. And then you look in the sky and look where that ship lands, because it won't show up on your map. And then you run towards that ship, and it's usually a bunch of settlers who are like, man, we landed and we're just out of water. Do you have any water? And you just get on their ship and fly away, and there's zero consequences.
Yeah. I mean, you got to put them out of their misery at the very least, right?
No, you are by
take care of
that. You are by not giving them the water.
But they can always walk 700 meters to an abandoned research station,
yeah,
or 300 meters to a geographical anomaly or geological anomaly. Like the map has plenty. It'll randomly generate whatever they need. Is that all
just
you
like,
say about
just like real life?
Okay, so Sam and Mark have beaten it. I'm about 8 hours in myself, so I according to a lot of people, I could be about halfway through the main story.
Yeah, you probably got like an hour left.
My short answer is that I like it and I'm having fun with it. But maybe I'll let the people who have actually beaten it first go first. Sam, what do you think about Starfield?
I think it is a bunch of cool stuff from Bethesda games in there that I really like, including like some cool story missions with permutations that are interesting, and then a really cool in-game handoff to the new game plus. There's a bunch of, that's really neat, and then like combat's fine and everything. I have no problem with that. It just doesn't have any exploration. It doesn't have a world to explore. It doesn't have strange new worlds to encounter. It just has nothing. It has the barest bones No Man's Sky at launch minus 100. Like, it just has nothing. You can land on planets and it randomly generates a cave, and you'll see that cave 1,000 times if you go to 1,000 planets. And then there might be a research station, a few other things. It doesn't have anything where you're going to be like, I had the coolest thing happen to me last night. And then your friend can say, oh, I want to go do that too, because everything's randomized. So I just think for me, for Bethesda games, for specifically Bethesda games, what I want to do is like look up at the horizon and be like, whoa, that sign looks weird. Or that mountain looks weird. Or what's flying over there? And then walk to it and explore it and then be rewarded for that. And this, it's not just that you can not find things to walk towards. I mean, if a planet is blue and you're like, I really like blue planets, I want to see what that looks like. Sure, land on it. There's going to be a lot of blue rocks on that planet. And then you look around and everything is randomly generated. It'll be like 3 geological formations, maybe some plants, and then, maybe a research station that you landed near to check out. But if you go in that station, there's no guarantee that you're going to be like, your friend is going to say in Skyrim, oh my gosh, did you do that? Because when you come out of there, you're a vampire, and it's like really cool, and like you can do all these things. Or maybe there's a sword in there that everybody really likes, but not in this game, because that's been randomly generated. So you go in there and like you don't even know if there's going to be like a perk magazine or the equivalent of a Pip-Boy or anything, because you might not find that, and there's no rules about it, and very well you might come out of there with fewer, with too much inventory and 200 credits. And like, I don't know, like it's missing that part of Bethesda game, and what's there does not make up for it for me personally.
Yeah. In a game that rewards you so handsomely with credits, like you can get 100,000 credits in no time at all. And so in a game where you spend 45 minutes clearing an outpost and you're like, I made $3,000 from that. Like that's nothing, right? That's nothing to me. I'm with Sam a lot. Like, I do like the game.
I like the game also.
I very much agree with R7. I think Dan's review is great. I think you should read the words if you don't agree with the score, and he will convince you, because it's a very well written review, and he justifies it very well. But yeah, I'm liking the characters a lot more than I think other people on staff have been. Like, I'm a Sarah Morgan simp. I think she's great. A lot of people don't really like her.
She's the first a lot person of, that follows you around?
Yeah, she's the constellation person that follows you around.
I'm with her too.
I think the gunplay, and there's been, it's known that id Software kind of helped them out with the gunplay. It shows. I think the gunplay is really cool. At this point, we can't say that like powers are not the thing. People, you get the powers a couple hours in. They're cool. I think some of them are, I think most of them are useless, but some of them are really cool.
There's two categories. It's like useless and overpowered. Actually, yeah, there's another category. Yeah. There's another category from the end of the game, which is, why the hell didn't they give me this earlier?
Oh,
it's
I know.
There's powers for collecting resources. And it's like, okay, now you can just hit a button to run past everything you could mine. That's just mean.
Yeah, it's very rude to be handed the keys to the kingdom after you've spent like 100 hours doing all this stuff.
Hey, everybody. By the way, don't mine anything.
Yeah,
you
just don't
need it till the end of the game. You don't need it till the end of the game. And then when you and even then, you don't need it. But if you want to play with systems, you could use materials. But there's many other ways to get them. And also, like, you get a thing where you snap your fingers and all the rocks fly into your back.
Oh, well, that's
if you were itching to build an outpost that serves no function, then wait for that. There's three things I don't like about the game. Two of them are Todd Howard's fault, well, Bethesda's fault, and one of them is my fault.
Okay.
The first thing I don't like, and I'm going to say this is Bethesda's fault, is they... For one, I think the game kind of falls short of what they made for Fallout 4. I think it's a step back in a lot of their systems.
I agree with that.
And
like something, inventory
being a huge part of it. something happened between 2015 and 2023, right? We got Breath of the Wild and we got Elden Ring. Two games that like turned open world exploration into something we never thought was like possible. And Bethesda said, We're not going to learn any lessons from any of that. We're going to make a game that has no exploration at all. And then the second thing is like, I think the graphics are just not that good, and that's kind of a bummer. Like in 2023, I'm playing on a PC.
You're playing on a good rig, right?
I have an RTX 4090, and I think this game just most of the time, I think it looks good on like moons. But that's because there's like not that many textures.
I mean, the HDR is fundamentally broken on PC.
So right.
It just doesn't work.
The moment a tree lands in the, like I see a tree in this game, I'm like, oh no, is that a tree from
I think
Xbox 360?
On the Xbox, it looks good. There's details that are really impressive. Like sometimes somebody will show, like we've been sharing pictures with each other, and somebody shared like a accidental kill they did in a room. And then you zoom in on a coffee mug and there's like a blood spatter like on the coffee mug that like looks like perfect. That has no bearing on you having fun in the game. But I was impressed at times with stuff like that. But, you know, it does also look like Fallout people talking with rubber faces.
Yeah.
Right?
Well,
and the outsides are like, there's not many exteriors anyway, right? It's like a bare planet and a couple cities.
The handcrafted cities like neon looks really, really cool. Like they did the global illumination and it shows like it does look really cool. But Sam basically covered everything when it comes to exploration. Like this is that it's their fault. They said that this game had unparalleled exploration when I would argue that the exploration is very paralleled. Many other games have added exploration and have done it way better. So the moment I stopped looking at this as an space exploration game and started looking at it as a Bethesda game with a space setting, I liked it a lot more because I was like, this just
like
isn't
Mass
what
Effect.
I thought it was. It's way closer to Mass Effect than it is to No Man's Sky. Like you're not exploring in this game. You're talking to people. Mm-hmm. The problem is the story is not as good as Mass Effect. So then you're just kind of like, what are we doing here?
I know, like just to keep on, you know, coming down and start feeling, which is unnecessary because I did have fun playing it. But like the Mass Effect world for me is just more interesting. Like it's not a NASA punk game. It's just a NASA game.
Yeah,
like it's just the spaceships are samey, the planets are samey, and what do you get? Well, the same thing you get on Earth, like a religious zealots, a militant faction, you know, like criminals. Like it's just not interesting.
A cowboy
like,
faction.
Those are not interesting factions. Like Mass Effect. You're like, oh, this species are jellyfish that are proselytizing to you.
Yeah.
Like that's cool. You know, like that's different. Or like, this is a species that's like, doesn't have a gender and like there's romance options for them. Like that's like really interesting in that game. Or like, you know, the Battlestar Galactica knockoff of the species that is only in their ships because their planet was destroyed. Like there's just really neat stuff when you have aliens, like that makes it neat. But like, you know, like in Starfield, like you're just going to encounter a lot of like people that are like trying to settle or trying to sell you on something,
yeah,
or a scientist.
The Also, the AI is just really weird. You can point your guns at people, nobody reacts. Like, there's a lot of like weird old gen stuff in this game.
Every time you finish a conversation, I accidentally pull out my gun. I'm like, oh, sorry, dude. Sorry, I didn't mean to do that.
I kept putting my gun down in towns, and I'm like, oh, actually, they don't care, like, at all. The most you'll get is if you shoot a gun, Sarah will be like, hey, there's a time and place for that, and you're like, okay, my bad. The last point I'll make for Starfield is like. I've played the game for probably close to 70 hours. To me, that's enough. I expected to play the game more. And that's where I'm saying is like, that's my third point where I say it's my fault. I expected more from the game. But the time I've had with it, I did enjoy. But I didn't expect that by September 7th, I would already be more than willing to move on. And I am more than willing to move on. Like, I'm done. But also, like, anything that me and Sam are saying, or anybody on this podcast, or anybody on any podcast is saying about this game, should not deter you if you are like loving it. That a review should never live rent free in anybody's mind, right? We gave the game a 7. That should only factor in whether you buy the game or not. The moment you have it, you shouldn't think about anybody's review ever again. Just play the game. Don't think about what Mark said on a podcast or Sam said. Just play the game. And if you're loving it, just. That's it.
Yeah.
That's all. It's as simple as that.
There are a lot of people loving it. I mean, the game is a huge hit. Even before it was
concurrent players.
Even before it was fully released, what they did with their early access was actually like whether or not you like it, no matter how you feel about it, a shrewdly brilliant business move by Xbox, because like a game that was formerly going to just, you know, be in everyone's Game Pass day one, so Xbox would not have received any additional income from that. They figured out a way to get people to buy it anyway.
I double dipped.
And I'm not mad about it.
It's actually not a new practice. They did this with Forza as well.
They did it with Forza, but this is a bigger.
And it also
a bigger
release,
deal.
Sure, the sure. Early access also released ahead of, in the U.S., a 4-day weekend or a 3-day weekend. Yes, so it was just
took a 4-day weekend.
I work Gamescom, okay? I get an extra day. So it was very much like, oh, I got a whole giant weekend to play this brand new Bethesda game. Like, of course I'm going to do it. Why not? It's like one of the biggest games of the year.
It's the FOMO gets you, and the FOMO got me. Everybody was talking about it, so I was like, okay, I was not planning on purchasing this early, but I went ahead and did it.
Damon, what do you think so far? Like, what's your take on it?
Like I said, I like it. I'm 8 hours in, which according to many people is a few hours before it gets really good. I would say that's terrible game design. I expect a game to be really good when I press the start button.
It gets good in the second season, Damon. Yeah.
But I am
60
liking it.
Hours in.
I do think it's the cookie cutter Bethesda style game, but I don't think it's up to the standard of Fallout or Skyrim. Fallout has the cool, it has the 50s, the kitschy 1950s.
It has personality.
Setting, it has that personality. Yeah. And it has the VATS system in combat, which I love.
Yeah.
The combat feels very basic to me in Starfield. And then Skyrim, you know, I wield magic spells out of, you know, both of my hands. It's just like a lot more interesting than just walking around with a pistol and shooting people in Starfield. And I think the fact that the world is split up among all these planets somehow makes Starfield feel smaller than Fallout or Skyrim.
Feels more disjointed to me because I'm in that same boat, and not to be a broken record or hammer the nail even harder, but it really feels like this is the first time Bethesda has designed a game that is, like, there is no incentive to explore because all of the systems designed around getting from point A to point B are designed to show you what the authored experiences are at each location that you want to go to. And there's no real reason to roam off the authored experience unless you really want to collect resources for an outpost. But it sounds like, really, as long as you play through the main game, you'll get everything you need just by, you know, stuff that they introduce later on. That said, totally agree. Love the gunplay moment to moment. I really feel the evolution of the moment to moment combat from Fallout 4. The big highlight for me being the zero-G space casino, and I'm like taking it over from bandits. Like, and you know, you're using your kinetic weapons, accidentally firing a shotgun while in zero-G, and it pushes you back up against the wall. I was like, okay, that rocked. Also, love the. I did not like the ship combat. But then once I was like, okay, hold on, I need to unpack the ship combat because I'm getting smoked every time I'm going after these bandits. What's going on? Anytime I have to take on three or more bandits in space, having a bad time. Here's a pro tip. Yeah. Upgraded my ship. I did actually upgrade my ship. I changed parts out. I designed a ship that I wanted. Get your mobility to as close to 100 as possible, and the game will feel so much better when you're doing open air space combat.
But when you did your ship upgrades, did you actually upgrade your skills to do the real upgrades, or did you just do it within the class?
I did both. So I took the perks that allowed a VAT style targeting. Yeah,
so
it is
a grind. You can recommend that, but it's a huge amount of work to just get to that basic level of ship build, which like that also like kind of makes me a little bit like nervous to start it. I did it now, but like when I was looking at staring it down, I was like, okay, so I'm gonna spend 4 hours to just like get my ship ability to buy parts that are expensive. Like that's crazy.
And that's the biggest problem. Why, like there are so many systems in the game that, you know, I definitely come from a camp of, I don't want everything spoon fed to me as far as how a game needs to be played. But when you, once you open that ship building thing, it's like, I don't even know what I'm looking at, dude. This doesn't make any sense. And it's... just through
Mark, remember you and I talking about that early?
Oh my gosh.
Like, literally just tell me what button I have to click to add a part. And it's like, oh, yeah. Okay, here. You don't click the ship. You have to click any random space out in space. And then it brings up the menu to start building the ship. But until then, it will not do that. It's just absolute madness.
Through sheer force of will.
You don't realize how much you need Google when there's, you know,
dude,
it's pre-release.
We were gameplay counseling each other. We were basically like live chatting the staff just to be like, so like seriously, I have contraband and I cannot land anywhere. What am I supposed to do with this? Like, what do I do? And like, there's just no way to know that. That's kind of fun stuff.
You sell it and then you buy it back. What do you mean? You've never sold contraband before, guys? Come on.
Oh, I'm sorry, Nick. What did you Google that answer?
No,
we were out there.
I intuited it because that's what the game expects you to do. Like that's the thing with me. There's things in this game that are designed for you to uncover.
You can't sell contraband because you can't enter a system with contraband with any sellers. So you have to know of a system that has sellers.
I guess I got lucky because I just sold it to the UC dudes.
That's
lucky.
That's the problem.
Well,
and yeah, there's a lot of things that I'm explaining there.
That's also, like a problem. You can't just say go to a vendor. You literally can't go to a vendor.
These chumps got stuck in jail, but I made it out scot-free.
Hey, getting thrown in jail is dope because then you get to join the Crimson Fleet, and that's like one of the best parts of the game. So
You have to get arrested once to get the whole faction quest.
Yeah. Yep. I agree with all the critiques about the menus. It's all so clunky trying to navigate through all that.
Yeah.
A lot of unnecessary menus, too.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, we have decades of data on what works in a video game menu. You don't just go with that, Bethesda. You don't need to reinvent the wheel.
I mean, Bethesda hired a modder to do like the cluttering and stuff like that. I was like, hire the modder to do the sky UI.
Fallout 4. I had to jump into Fallout 4 to capture. There's a scene in our review that I captured for Dan where it shows Fallout 4, shows you pulling up your menu, and then it shows it like if you go to a vendor and it shows their menu on the other side. Why did they take that out? Like I can't like fathom why they were like, hey, you know how you could see both?
And they don't tell you when you can see both. There's like certain times you go to a vendor on a planet and if you click the LB button, you can actually self-strike from your ship. Mm-hmm. Like you would never know that when you just show up on Cydonia or like, I wish I could sell all the stuff in my ship.
You don't ever really know that there's a shared inventory either without poking around, just analyzing every menu and every button prompt.
And I think this is where our confusions with the contraband came from, is that your ship, your default ship, the Frontier, has a cargo hold and a captain's locker, and it never tells you what the difference between those two are. And so I was like, oh, the captain's locker, that's for the contraband. Nope, you need to have a shielded cargo for contraband.
And good luck finding one.
And good luck. Just do the Mantis side quest. I'm just telling everybody right now, go do the Mantis side quest, get the Razor Leaf, you're good to go.
But to check out the Mantis side quest, you have to look up how to do that, because it doesn't just fall in your lap, so that's a problem too.
Go to ign.com/wiki/Starfield.
Yeah, like, you know, again, 8 hours in, my impression is that I like it, just not as much as Fallout or Skyrim. How much time have you spent with it, Nick?
I'm like 20 hours in, roughly. Definitely feeling the pains from, like, I loved Fallout 4. I know mechanically and, like, I think narratively, Fallout 4 kind of suffers in comparison to something like New Vegas. But, I'm digging it. The one thing that I'm kind of tired of with a lot of Bethesda RPGs is the
do it, like, you can do everything as the player because you are the most important person in the world of the games. Like, that's what I really, that's what I really miss from New Vegas, where you can lock yourself out of content because you made a choice to side with X faction, whereas Starfield is very much in the Skyrim vein. It's like, nah, you can do everything, dude. You're the most important character here.
It's that Bethesda trope, right? Yeah. You're a nobody. You're a miner. Literally an hour later, you're like,
you are a god.
High
Someone
ranking
shows
constellation
up, just gives
member.
You their ship.
Yes,
take my ship.
Yeah, literally, dude's like, ship. I don't know, man. You got this weird alien artifact. You're probably important.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and they would just let anyone go get that alien artifact and touch it. Like, whatever. Anyone's fine.
Yeah. There's examples of very weak storytelling in it, and then there's examples of really fun storytelling in it.
Yeah.
There's moments. Yeah.
The faction quests are the standout.
Yeah, like, the UC stuff was really so much fun. Like, I loved exploring the modern museum that they have, learning about the history of the world of Starfield, and then that stuff pops up. It pops up in interesting ways, and you can also, like, answer questions based on knowledge that you learn from that museum, and the game's like, oh, wow, you actually paid attention. I think that's
Well, last night I did my first side quest that I really liked. I think it's called First Contact. Anyone know this one? Remember that one? I'll talk about it for a minute, so in case, you know, it's just a side quest, but in case you don't want a spoiler, you can jump ahead a couple minutes, because it's called First Contact. It's where you find there's, like, a planet with, like, a resort on it, and people are walking around in bathing suits and stuff, and so it's just this, like, fancy resort. But this ship has appeared in an orbit that's like an eyesore to them, and they can't communicate with them,
oh,
so they ask...
Oh, my gosh.
You remember this one? Have you done this? So they asked me to go up and, like...
No, it just sounds awesome.
I know about this one.
They go up and, you know, see what the deal is. And when I get up there and I dock on the ship, I find out that it's, like... a generational ship, where it's a ship that left from Earth hundreds of years ago carrying a group of people, and over time they had children, and the original people died, and then the next people had children and they died, and finally they, because they left Earth, everyone had to leave Earth. Things got really bad. It was time to get the F out of Dodge from Earth. And so now finally they've arrived at their destination, which is this planet that already has this resort in it, but their communication stuff from when the ship was built hundreds of years ago can't communicate with the planet now. And they just want to, like, land on this planet and finally start their new life. And the captain of the planet is, like, the great-great-great-great-granddaughter of the original people. And I'm like, well, this is such a cool idea. You could do so much with this.
Fun.
This could be a TV show or a movie.
I mean, that sounds like a vault from Fallout, like the concept of
the
vault.
That's exactly what I was going to say, Nick. Yep. And that's another thing this game is missing, is that you could play this with not ever finding what Damon found. And that's fine, right? Because sometimes you wouldn't find a vault. But there's also, like, there's not that much of it. And, like, a bunch of people I know have been playing this game, and Dan called out that exact thing as the coolest side quest he found in the entire game in his review. And, like there's just not a lot of that. Like, if there was 100 scenarios like that, and you're like, you just got to find them, you got to go to the planetary systems and look for somebody that appears, then, like, I would have the motivation to go do that. That'd be really neat. But you, 100% of the time, you go to a system without anything there, nothing happens. And then you go to a planet and you're like, go to a few more and you're like, okay, the third one I went to, somebody tried to talk to me, but it's a scientist looking for iron, and then they just move on. It's like, it just doesn't have that vault stuff.
Yeah.
Not enough authored experiences. Mm. The ones that are there are very good, but man, just the lack, you really feel the lack of them when there's very little to do outside of the authored experiences.
Yeah.
Here's something I wanted to bring up, something that I think could drive a certain group of people insane. I think, and this could be up for debate, I think a 7 out of 10 takes Starfield completely out of the discussion for Game of the Year. And there's some talk about this in the Facebook group. Someone asked just that very question, and Pear actually responded saying, we don't consider scores when nominating games for Game of the Year. Okay, but let's see. I have some data here.
Oh, here we go. Yo, is this a surprise Game of the Year watch episode? Let's go.
49 games have scored higher than Starfield this year. So there'd be some real mental gymnastics would have to be made to justify why Starfield would need to be nominated.
But
over
damn it, I think
49 other
games.
The point is
that we give our reviewers complete leeway to evaluate a game on their own.
That's true.
There is a chance that one of our coworkers would really like or really dislike a game that turns out that the rest of the staff just was head over heels over. Mm-hmm. Now, that could have happened for a game like Undertale that year, right? Mm-hmm. Like, say somebody was assigned Undertale and it wasn't a worldwide phenomenon, and then everybody on staff played it, and now it's a bunch of people's favorite game on our staff. Like, that year, it could have won Game of the Year. This is not what happened. I'm not even saying, I'm just using this complete off-the-wall example. I don't remember what happened that year with Undertale, but that would be an example of, like, maybe Undertale could have gotten a 6 from somebody who just didn't care at all about it, and then a bunch of other people are like, that's my 11 out of 10 game. Mm-hmm. That's a chance where that could happen.
Sure. Somebody would have to make...
That's never happened before.
It has never... I wanted to point that out. A 7 has never won Game of the Year, and I don't think a 7 has ever even been nominated for Game of the Year.
I think somebody would have to really make a just like court case of the century style case. Like the thing I've always appreciated about the IGN Game of the Year discussion, I've always like when I was an outsider looking, I was like, what does that actually look like? Once I joined, it gets heated. People have to stand up and like make the case for the game. So you would have to be just lawyer material to make the case.
But what's cool about it though is we do have those Game of the Year meetings, right? Compared to Sam and Damon, I'm still like a baby at IGN, but I've been a staff member since 2017. So that's a lot of, we may have these like big meetings, but at the end of the day, it's like we just vote. And it really doesn't matter what happened in those meetings. You could go rogue and just be like, this was my game of the year.
To just kind of back up everybody's points about game scores too, like take this scenario. There's absolutely people on our staff that don't like Breath of the Wild or Tears of the Kingdom.
Yeah.
And should one of those people have reviewed the game, that probably would have been like a weird pairing for, you know, editorially to get somebody to review a game, but maybe they like Breath of the Wild and really didn't like Tears of the Kingdom. But whatever the case, there's people that bounced off Tears of the Kingdom. They would have absolutely given that game somewhere in the 6-7 region, maybe even lower, right? And if that had happened, that game would still be a contender for Game of the Year. We just don't do our review assignments that way. You know, Dan took on Starfield because he's the biggest Bethesda fan I know. Like, from way back. Mm-hmm. Like,
he reviewed Fallout 4. He reviewed, like, all the Mass Effect games.
I mean, 1 and 2 are, like, his favorite games ever, right? Besides, mm-hmm. I guess, XCOM. So, like, it totally makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. Is it just 2? I don't know. I don't know anything about Fallout 1 and 2.
Fallout 2 is great. Fallout 1's really good. Two rules
is the one I want them to return to that setting because that's the one in San Francisco, correct? And I'm like, man, I would love a Fallout.
Is it really? So that's the one that talks about the California Republic.
You're right, cool. but they're top down. They're a different type of game.
Yeah. Hey, top down games are popular again. CRPGs are back, baby.
They are a different type of game. And that's what I was about to say. So it's like when I think about like Game of the Year, I think about a game that like I could not wait to play. And after 70 hours of Starfield, there's never been a moment where I'm like, I cannot wait to play this. I can't wait for work to get over or the weekend.
Mark and I had to work on this game for a couple of weeks, and it was kind of like I'm going to work on this during work hours after
Starfield quickly became my this is my work game versus Tears of the Kingdom that I got the game at launch. You know, I didn't get it early. I went to the store and bought it like everybody else. I played it all weekend, probably 20 hours, and then was like, oh man, I gotta go to work tomorrow. Oh wait, my job is to play and cover this game. I can't wait. And I would just play and I would cover it, and then I'd eat dinner, and then I would just play Zelda. Like, I couldn't wait.
Mark, are you like Baldur's Gate 3 though also, right?
So I was gonna, that's next, Baldur's Gate 3. Every time I'm not playing Baldur's Gate 3, I want to be playing Baldur's Gate 3. That's how I was for Diablo when Diablo first came out, and Hogwarts Legacy. So like those are my four right now that I would choose. Starfield is not even on that list for me. There's never been a moment where I'm like, I cannot wait to play Starfield. And sorry, after 70 hours, that's no longer my problem if your game hasn't grabbed me yet.
Yeah, I think Resident Evil 4, Metroid have grabbed me the most besides Zelda this year. Those are my others right now. But Metroid won't count for Game of our year, but I love that game.
I haven't even finished Starfield, but I'm just thinking, maybe I should go for the second and third ending in Armored Core 6 again.
There you go.
Nice.
We were talking.
I'm wondering how much it's not fair, but I'm also wondering how much Baldur's Gate kind of ruined like Starfield for me, because I don't know if any, like, did anybody else play Baldur's Gate? Like,
oh yeah,
I've
just dipped my toes in it.
Bethesda was the quintessential like you see that man there, you could shoot him in the face, and it's going to completely change everything about the game. And then you kind of quickly kind of figure out that that's actually not true. But, like, there's a lot of characters you can't kill.
Like, Bethesda hasn't really been that Bethesda since Morrowind, though. Like, Morrowind was like, dude, you've altered fate forever by killing this quest giver. Good luck. We suggest rolling back your save. Exactly.
Baldur's Gate has so many, like, opportunities to solve every problem. I don't know how they do it. Every time you, like, touch a blade of grass in that game, your quest log gets updated because everything you did affected some of the quests. My wife is pissed because she's been playing so much Baldur's Gate, and then all of a sudden she found out, she's trying to, like, get with the druid guy. She found out he left the camp, and she can't figure out why, and she had to revert back, like, 8 hours because the game, it was just, she finally found it, and it was just like, Halsum does not agree with the way you handled that and has left to start his own journey, and that's it. He's gone. And so she's like, nope, and she reverted back. She wants her druid daddy.
That's great.
What a game, man. That's crazy.
Yeah, I did.
That's going to be splitting the staff, right?
I just fired up
The game's all about it.
The PS5 version of Baldur's Gate this week. But I think I'm going to mainline Starfield first and then come back to that. I know I'm going to love Baldur's Gate.
You know, when it comes to wireless carriers, sometimes what you see isn't always what you get, except with Visible. With Visible, what you see is exactly what you get. If you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. With Visible, there are no hidden fees, no fine print, no hassle, nothing to hide. It's just $25 a month, all taxes and fees included. And you don't need more than one line of wireless to save. You can save on a line all to yourself with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. And again, just $25 a month. The future of wireless is here, and it is transparent. If you want more transparency in your wireless plan, you want to be on the Visible plan. Switch to Visible today and save at Visible.com. That's Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. This episode of Game Scoop is brought to you by NordVPN. As Scoop Nation knows, your Omega Cops have been a little obsessed with a movie called Weekend at Bernie's lately. But as happens too often these days, it is difficult to find it streaming here in the US. That's where NordVPN comes in. With NordVPN, you can switch your virtual location to a more enlightened region where they appreciate the comic delights of Weekend at Bernie's. And it's not just for streaming movies and shows. Switching your virtual location can allow you to save money by purchasing flights, hotels, and subscriptions from other countries at a cheaper price. And you can do all this worry-free as NordVPN threat protection features protect you from viruses, malware, and phishing sites. Best of all, NordVPN costs the price of a cup of coffee a month, and one account can be used on up to 6 devices. To get the best discount on your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/gamescoop. Our link will also give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. That's nordvpn.com/gamescoop.
But then before all that, on my trip to Germany for Gamescom, I played a hell of a lot of Pikmin 4.
Oh, man.
And it's so good.
Oh, what a game.
Like, Sam has been singing its praises for a while now, but, like, it's easily the best Pikmin game. I think it's, like, my top 3 games of the year. I think it's probably Tears of the Kingdom.
I forgot about that. I would throw that in mine, too.
Resident Evil 4 and Pikmin 4. It's so good. And I've played all the Pikmin games. I've liked them all.
It's the only franchise that I could say every game has just been better than the last one, and it's like iterated in
this
such a way.
This is a big leap too.
Yeah,
exactly. I devoured Pikmin 4 in like 1 weekend, 100% of that bad boy. Wow. I'm so sad. It's done. Like I love that game.
I haven't played
so
it,
much.
But it looks like my game. So I think I'm gonna wait for like Christmas. You know,
that's a good time to play.
That time like, where it's like, all right, well, because we do that for game of the year, right? That's another like point that is like we try to take December to like get through all the, and this is like totally a blind spot for me.
This makes me want to play it right now.
Dude, use that Nintendo voucher, get Mario Wonder, get Pikmin 4, call it a day.
I used the voucher for Tears of the Kingdom and Pikmin 4.
That's what I did too.
Oh, I don't know what that is. Tell me about it after the podcast, because I don't know what that is.
$100 voucher.
You have to be a Switch Online member though to get access to the privilege to pay $100.
Then you pay $100 and you get to redeem it for 2 games. So you're saving like what, $20-$30?
Yeah, exactly.
$20. Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I might as well, because I'm absolutely going to buy Mario Wonder. Come on.
Yeah, I think it's just all the first-party stuff. Most of the first-party stuff, I believe. Yeah.
But Damon, was that not, as you teased, the best game that you played this week?
That's not the best entertainment software I've been experiencing recently.
Oh, gosh.
That honor goes to The Making of Karateka.
Oh, man. I got to check that out.
It's so good. It's amazing. And I know Sam's been playing it too, watching
it. I beat it last night, and I freaking beat Karateka for the first time ever.
Yeah.
I beat the game after, like, watching these documentaries, a game that I don't give a crap about until I watch these documentaries. And I was like, this is the coolest game ever.
Dude, it's so. And so, first of all, Jordan Mechner does pronounce it Karateka, but I still don't like that.
I thought it was Karateka.
It should be. Because it's a real word, Japanese word that just means someone who practices karate. I don't know why adding ka at the end would change the pronunciation of the word.
Is this a digital eclipse?
Digital eclipse.
Produce? Yeah.
So just the best.
They're pros.
Just the best at preserving older games and contextualizing them. So they did Atari 50 last year. They did the Kawabunga
collection.
This is the
same package as Atari 50, where it throws a timeline. Yeah, of the game's creation with infinite things about that game and a documentary interposed. That is wonderful. Best dad in games ever.
Oh my god. What?
Better than Kratos, better than anybody. This is the best father ever. It's Jordan Mechner's real life father.
And what a gift. He's still with us and he's all over this thing. He's in all these interviews and he's so great and so cool. I just can't believe this package is so awesome.
This dad, like, did the soundtrack for his teenage son's game, talked to him about it constantly.
Yes.
And remembers all of these moments now. And it was like, remember when I told you to add the Torii gates in and I showed you from my photos from going to Japan? He's like, wow, actually, I didn't remember that till now, but now I do remember. It's like the sweetest
It's so good.
Thing. It's unbelievable.
And like, Karateka's not, you know, it was an important influential at the time, but I don't think people talk about it very much today. On this very show, we spent a lot of time talking about old games. I don't know that we've ever had much of a conversation about Karateka, but like, this still got made and exists and is amazing. Anyone in Scoop Nation that has like an interest in retro gaming, classic gaming, you have to check it out. It's required playing and viewing. It also like makes playable early like prototypes of games that Jordan Mechner made before Karateka that were like
right
a lot of Asteroid ripoffs. They're just playable now and there's some you can play different prototype versions of Karateka. And then Digital Eclipse has made their own modernized take on Karateka. That's very cool to play through.
And that's the one that I beat, and it has commentary that goes on as you move along in it.
Yes.
And the documentary explains to you what's amazing about Karateka, and then Mike Micah, the developer at Other Ocean, who does the commentary, explains to you basically from his perspective why it's a really difficult game to recreate or port. And both are like interesting stories. And one you learn while you play the game. And like, again, like I played it a couple times and then I watched the docs and I played a little more and then I watched the docs. And then I was like, I have to beat this game after watching the docs. And I had a really fun time by the end of it because I understood why it was interesting and fun. And I gave myself 11 lives and I was able to beat it.
I feel like you guys have probably seen this a lot just because you've been, you know, at IGN much longer than myself or Mark, but I feel like a hypothetical question that always comes up in our space is just, what does a Criterion Edition of video games look like?
Exactly.
And like, ever since, you know, Mega Man Legacy Edition or Legacy Collection, it's like, nobody does it like Digital Eclipse because, like you said, they provide all the context you need if you're learning what this is for the very first time. So I'm very excited to dive in and check this. I can play it on anything.
But let me just like one up that for a second. Their packages before of collections were great. Like we gave them high scores usually. They're great. But this is like a living museum that's interactive and playable. It's as fun to play as it is to watch and interact with. It's a new level of any multimedia teaching about the past. It's remarkable. And Atari 50, I said all that in my review. Like, I cannot believe it. And to see the second one come out for like a game that I really didn't care about at all is amazing. And of course, like at the end, they have a little teaser for the first Prince of Persia, which is like, they could easily do that next, you know? But like, it's incredible.
Yeah, it's... there's like three things that made Karateka cool at the time. It was like, it was more cinematic than any game had been before that. And then of course there's the animations, the rotoscope animations, which were a suggestion by Jordan Mechner's father.
Jeez.
And then he has all the footage. It's just it's him, his dad and his sister running around in the woods behind their house. And he has all this Super 8 footage of them doing the moves from the game. And his mother's...
And they superimpose it in the documentaries. Yeah. And then there's a little interactive feature where you can draw a bar back and forth and watch the animations play out.
That's so, so cool.
Yeah. And then the third thing was the music. It actually had a score, which was really unusual at the time. And the score was written by Jordan Mechter's dad, who's a classically trained pianist. It's just like, what?
And who figured out how to make the buzzes made by a chip on the Mac or the Apple
II.
Like into tones that were equivalent to what he was composing on a piano.
Wow.
Like, they basically invented these, like, melodies. Like, there's barely any melodies on a computer at this point. There were in arcade games and stuff, but to get it out of the Apple was, like, they explain all that. It's incredible.
It's like using machine sounds? That's wild.
Yeah. Basically a buzz that one chip can do. One thing that Jordan Mechner is like, Dad, like, what did you even think of video games or, like, me being into this and not really going to class? And he's like, well, I just thought it would be like super important to support your passions, because when a parent supports a kid's passions, it usually turns out okay.
Oh.
I'm like, that is the most profound, like crazy trust he put into his kid, and it worked out. But you can tell it worked for his father too, because his father's like, you know, like he's a businessman,
kind of a Renaissance
like
man.
But he's like a composer and he's a classical pianist and like all this stuff, you know, and like you can just tell that he pursued his passions and was successful in it.
Yeah,
it's heartwarming.
Where can I experience this?
I think it's on every...
It's platform. On everything.
Yeah, I played on PS5.
Switch is what I did.
It's on great. Switch. It's on PC. It's so great. It's just the making of Karateka, Karateka. It's amazing. Okay, the one other thing I wanted to mention this week is we got a bunch of updates on Mario Wonder. There was a Nintendo Direct. This is a week or two ago now. I continue to think Mario Wonder looks awesome, but when this game was originally announced, Sam wasn't too impressed, and I wonder if that's changed at all.
Yeah.
He's still not into it.
Ready? Ready?
Yep.
Ready?
Oh, he's doing it.
Two thumbs.
Cool. Yeah.
Oh. He's just walking Phoenix from Gladiator.
No, it was great. What I like about this game now is what they showed in the Direct and what Ryan McCaffrey had to say in his preview.
Yeah.
But the Direct really showed... But, you know, it will it's going to be a new Super Mario Brothers game, right? There might be three things to collect per level, but I like how the map screen has a little bit of the, now you can go to any level in order in those kind of like open areas.
Open areas, yeah.
And then I like how the level transformations look completely unique for each level. I like how they showed you could skip the end post on one level with a level transformation. Mm. Did you see that?
Funny.
That was like a little bit Mario World.
Huh.
So there's more in this game. It's never going to be... They never pace these games off of Yoshi's Island or Super Mario World or Mario 3. They're just not doing that. I don't know why. They're basing everything on New Super Mario Brothers, but this looks like a much better version of New Super Mario Brothers so far.
Yeah, I agree with that. I like this. So you got these 8 playable characters. 2 of them are for kids because Yoshi and Nabbit don't take damage.
Mm-hmm.
They can still fall into pits, but like that'll be good to handle.
They got to learn failure somehow.
Yeah, that'd be good to handle. But does anyone wish the characters play differently like they did in Mario 2?
In Mario 2, yeah. That's the
I
one
love
thing.
That.
Yeah.
I want Princess Peach to float.
Yeah.
There's so many things about, like, I'm not going to say, like,
Yoshi
the game,
floats.
Like, the game's got, like, worse, because that's absolutely not true. But, like, there's so many things about early Mario games that, exactly what Sam's saying, that it's like, what was it so magical about Mario 3 and Mario World that they can't recreate in the like new side scrolling Mario?
It's because they want to make them more accessible, so they don't want to do like, hey, by the fourth world you probably can't beat these levels if you're a little kid, you need help with them. They just don't want to do that, and then they don't want to do the, like, they feel like the way of like hiding things and making levels replayable and like super full of secrets, they feel like they're still doing that, but what they're doing really is doing that in like a really a smoothed over way. Like the idea of Mario World, like in some levels you could find a key, some levels you could find a secret exit by going under the goalpost, some levels just didn't have that at all. Like there's these variations, but these are like, okay, in every level there's going to be basically 3 big purple things, and we'll hide them. That's the secret they're going for, and like that's where maybe the level transformations will help with that a little bit. But that was the new Super Mario Bros. Thing. There's like, there's 3 big coins or whatever in each level. Mm-hmm. We'll hide them. But really, this game is about getting to the goalpost at the end, and we're going to make it pretty easy until World 8-4.
Well, and they took the 3D elements and put them in a side scroller, right? So like the triple jumping, the wall kicking, the stuff like that. And I think that made them a lot.
There's challenge
I don't know, the game
felt
like
good.
a lot less vertical. Remember, like in Mario 3, like you'd always want to fly because you'd always want to see what's up there. And Mario World, they like rewarded that all the time. Like you would just go up there and there'd just be coins up there. You're like, why?
The game does look cool. It's and just the XY is really important in Yoshi's Island too. All those levels are like sprawling levels, like just like passages that lead around and come back in caves, and you know, above ground with huge clouds. Like that's really good. But in these newer games, it's like, well, we'll make a level with a helicopter hat and you get a bunch of coins in the sky. But it's never like, if you have this, you can go explore this area that you didn't have before.
Oh, do you remember in like Mario 3? Like, yeah, you'd roll up into a level and it's like ice blocks and there's coins in there, and if you didn't have a firepower, I remember that used to like it used to blow my mind that I could remember that it's like, okay, I gotta have the firepower when I go into this level because then I get to hit, I get to melt all the blocks. Like that was so fun when I was a kid. Maybe it's just because I was a kid.
That's cool nuance in the games. If you save a P-Wing for the tank levels at the end, you can completely skip them.
Oh, man.
It's so fun.
The game does look cool. I'm just also a 3D Mario guy, and I want Mario Odyssey 2.
I think these are just they're pasteurized versions of those, but this looks like there's a little bit of twist. It's good. Now, there's some exceptions. New Super Luigi was extremely difficult. That's like Super Mario Brothers 2 Japan style, which I think is really interesting. Right. And then I think New Super Mario Brothers 2 is really cool because they just threw a bunch of stuff out the window and they're like, let's just make this about collecting as many coins as possible. And like, some people were like, well, this is different. I'm like, yeah, it's different. You don't just run to the end of the level. It's really neat. Like I think that game's really cool too. So there's been moments, so maybe this could be more like one of those two.
I just want to be Elephant Peach. And I get to be. Next month.
And Mario Maker has cool stuff that Nintendo made, right? Mario Maker's always had neat stuff.
Yeah. I think Mario Wonder looks awesome. Can't wait.
Yeah.
Okay, we have an email that is going to be relevant to at least Sam's interests. Viewers, listeners, remember you can always reach us at the email address gamescoop@ign.com, just like Andrew Robichaud did. And he said, over the weekend for Labor Day, we were able to successfully break the world record for marathon pinball. Has this news made it to your ears, Sam?
No.
The previous record was set in Canada in 2021 at the time of 48 hours total.
Jeez.
2 days of playing, I guess, one pinball machine. When it was finally time to call it quits, after I could not stand anymore, we had made it to 62 hours and 20 minutes. He was playing the Stranger Things table for that or machine for that long, Sam. It says, the Bat Cave, located in Lakeland, Florida, is a large collection of pinball games ranging from 1970 to current releases. Thank you to all the team who provided around-the-clock help to make this accomplishment possible. I would like to send an official invite to Sam to come and enjoy the mini machines we have down here in Lakeland, which includes all limited and collector's editions that have been released in the past few years.
Ooh, that's cool that they got the LEs and the CEs. That's normally not arcade fare. That's what my arcade here in San Francisco likes to specialize in, is getting these kind of rarer versions of the games that usually people just buy and put in their houses because they're really expensive. They're hard to pay off. So it's really an honor to have that. Now, I'm always like curious about marathon gaming. Like there's kind of funny things like in Asteroids or like Q-Bert, you can like rack up enough lives that you can like walk away and have a slice of pizza or go to the bathroom, right? And so it's like, I don't really understand in pinball like, you know, what that is. So I'd be just curious to know like what the Guinness situation setup is for that. Is it like, well, you actually get a break every 15 minutes every 15 hours.
Is it multiple people? Like in multiple?
No, it's just him. Yeah. And I like, they were talking about this on Reddit. You're allowed a 5-minute bathroom break once an hour and they're bankable. So if you don't have to go in 1 hour, then the next hour you have 10 minutes.
The bankable part feels broken to
really?
Me. I feel like the bankable part is like, nah, you only get 5 minutes, dude. There's no saving this up. So you want to use the bathroom or do you want to eat? You choose. I feel like that's the metagame you got to do with these Guinness.
So really the endurance is from staying awake for that long, which is really difficult, and doing anything.
Multiple days.
Let alone standing.
But then within the rules, though, you would bank enough 5 minutes so that you can sleep for like you get one REM cycle in and then you're good to go for another 12 hours.
45 minutes in 2 days. Only if you play 9 hours straight.
Anyway, I thought that was good. And he also go ahead, Sam.
How much did you hate Stranger Things after that?
That's not a great machine, is it?
It's okay. It's interesting because it like kind of knocks off the layout of a very famous game, Attack from Mars, where it has like a central thing that you hit a lot with like a ramp. It's kind of fun. Like it has a little projector that like opens up. It's really neat. But then the fan pattern around it is kind of like a nice like every shot thing. People that like pinball and playing pinball a lot really like that game. But you know, also Stranger Things goes in and out of people's interests, so it's not like a evergreen theme, so to speak.
Andrew also gave a 20-question suggestion that I did not select because I didn't think anybody would get it, not even Sam. It was high-speed pinball and NES. I don't know that.
I would have got that. Those are really funny. There's a high-speed actually 10 feet behind me, behind this row of games. But what's funny, they did that in Pinbot, and the PlayChoice has, like, I have a Pinbot for PlayChoice. It's like an upright NES game on the PlayChoice arcade machine.
That's awesome.
I've never played high-speed pinball, but it's a rare game.
Oh, wow. Like,
from I'd, rare. I'd have got that one.
Yeah, I bet you would.
Not one, though. No.
Well, that brings us to the real 20 questions pick. This week, our selection comes from Justin from Texas. And as a little hint, he says, this game was one of the more unique games I've ever played.
Oh, no. Oh,
high-speed pinball.
Let the questioning begin. How mean would that be if...
That's quite the zag, Damon.
That's also a funny game because it's from the Bally Midway era, pre-Williams. Hmm. So it's like that art, you know, the arcade maker that made Mortal Kombat stuff. So those machines have Midway looks.
Sorry, the hint was it's one of the more unique games he's ever played?
Yeah. That's correct. Oh.
All right. Is it from the 70s, 80s, or 90s?
No.
All right.
So maybe it's not. So it's not Seaman?
No.
That's the most unique game.
That's a pretty unique game.
It could be Hey You Pikachu, though. Oh, wait, no, that's 90s.
Oh. Yeah, I don't know. Nintendo 64 is a weird console.
Is this game made in Japan?
No.
Is it made in the U.S.?
No.
Okay.
Oh. It's made in Nova Scotia.
So, maybe it's like a UB game or something. Was this game originally a console exclusive?
No.
All right, we've narrowed nothing down. Let's see.
Did it originally come out on a disc-based medium?
Yes, that's five.
PlayStation. All right.
So not a Game Boy game or DS of any era.
Right.
But we have 23 years of.
Was this available on a Nintendo platform?
No.
Oh, cool. We need to nail down like generation. So
yeah, is this from the 360 generation?
Yes.
Okay. So perfect. 360 or PS3?
360, PS3, PC. He said no Nintendo console, so no like Wii.
And it's not a console exclusive.
Not exclusive. So it's come out to all of them.
What's a unique game on both of those? Maybe it's like. One
Call
versus
of Duty.
100. One versus 100 on the 360.
Yeah,
arcade.
Yeah.
Something
that's
like
very,
that.
Very unique. But did this game get good scores, Damon?
Yes.
Do we need to know if it's on the 360 specifically? Because what if it's cross-platform, but it's on iPhone and PC?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, because we said no console exclusive. But, man, that'd be super weird if it was. It's like it's part of that generation, but not on those consoles.
We can wait on that if we need.
Like, I want to say it's like something like Portal, because at the time Portal was unique. I don't know if in 2023 people would be like, that was the most unique game I've ever played. Like,
but I feel like you would frame like a unique experience as like that was unique, like something. There's a novelty to it as opposed to a cool gameplay mechanic. You know.
Yeah.
Well, we can get some genres out of the way. We can do like, is this a shooter, puzzle, or?
I feel like it could be a puzzle game. Like unique, like it could be a puzzle game.
Do we want to do
a
like
shooter,
try to
puzzle? Is this a shooter, puzzle, or action game?
all three.
Well, I mean, you're sweating. Action's a pretty broad genre.
Okay. Should I choose a different one?
I mean, just shooter, puzzle?
Like, you want to just include everything that could be in action? I can answer the question if you want to do that.
No.
I mean, the answer is yes, then.
yeah, the answer would be yes. And
do you play
everything's an action game.
Do you play as a...
human?
Human. Do you play as a human?
Yes.
Okay.
Chell is a human. Still poor.
Is this a violent game?
Yes, not overly so, but yeah.
Okay.
There's violence. And that's 10, by the way.
Is the violence done with guns?
not on your part.
Maybe it's something like Mad World or something. That game looks like crazy unique and there's violence.
I'm still getting Portal because there's guns, but you don't have the guns.
That's true.
The turrets have the guns. There's violence, but like not overly violent.
Do we
want to
ask if it was on PC too then?
But the puzzle thing would have tripped that, right?
He never answered that question.
I know, but like it wouldn't have been a problem because he could have just said yes.
Yeah.
Unique. Broad action game.
I'm trying to put myself in the mindset of something that's unique in the 360, because like that generation did create a lot of like unique experiences that in 2023 people may not find so unique. So it's like, did he find it unique back then, or is it still one of the most unique games?
Like there's Asura's Wrath. Asura's Wrath is getting hung up on it.
Okay, as a clarification, you can use weapons, but you are discouraged from using weapons. It does not, it's not helpful to you.
Oh, okay. Maybe it's something like Mirror's Edge, because Mirror's Edge, the guns are bad.
Oh,
and like running around in first person is really unique.
And because it was a parkour game. Most of the time you got a gun in Mirror's Edge, like once your ammo was gone, like you would just drop it.
Is this game in first person?
Yes.
I think it might be Mirror's Edge.
Does this game, it might be Mirror's Edge. Okay, does this game, feature parkour running?
Does this game feature parkour? Yes.
Does this game have stylish renditions of white and red?
Yes.
It's Mirror's Edge.
Is this game Mirror's Edge?
It is Mirror's Edge.
Yeah, let's go.
That was great, Nick.
It was a team effort.
You know what? And the thing is like, Mirror's Edge is still unique.
Dude,
like, I know
rocks.
Dying Light kind of has this mechanic, but Mirror's Edge was something else, man.
It still looks really good too because of the stylization. Mm-hmm. I wonder. I remember like having a little bit of fun, being like, "I'm going to play a killin' run of this, and you can't pick up guns and just shoot people."
It's one of those like games that obviously we've seen evolved on since with stuff like Neon White, mm-hmm. but there's something so pure about the original game where it was always like, "I got to do better." Like that wasn't as cool as it could have been. So restart level. I want to get the perfect run in.
Yeah.
Yep. Not. Developed by DICE, so not, they're Swedish?
That's Swedish, yeah.
Yeah, so not developed in the U.S.
Did you review this, Damon?
No, Nate Ahern did. Shout out to Nate Ahern.
Mm-hmm.
Former IGN.
What did IGN give Mirror's Edge, do we know?
I want to say the 360 version got like a high 7, but then the PC version got an 8, I want to say.
I can't ever like nail down why Catalyst didn't, like, I don't know. I don't know why. Like, why did that game like kill that franchise? I can't like figure out why. I think there was just a magic to it that couldn't be. Yeah, exactly. I think there's just a magic to it that they were like, let's make it bigger and better, and it turns out all we needed was the first one.
Yeah, I never played Catalyst.
Yeah, me either. As much as I love Mirror's Edge, I think there was something about the time that it released where I was just like, nah, I don't care about this.
Yeah.
Well, nicely job, everybody. Thank you for the suggestion, Justin in Texas. Viewers, listeners, if you have your own suggestions for 20 questions, email them to me at the email address gamescoop@ign.com. And that is all the scoops that we have for you this week. Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Mark. Thank you to Tom working behind the scenes to make this episode possible. My name is Damon. This is IGN Gamescoop, and we're out.
Nice.
Thank you. Anna Sheridan, New York Times best-selling author of supernatural horror. Missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. Is the compass broken? Or did I turn to the side passage?
Given the circumstances of her disappearance, someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil, so to speak.
Weak radio signal. 700 meters. Closing fast.
There's no place for ghost stories and close encounters in this investigation, or any other.
I need you to find me.
You to save yourself.
Of course. What else would it be?
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.